Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Brittany Latrice Cosby was born in Houston, Texas on July 20, 1990. In 2014, 23-year-old Brittany was living in Houston with her girlfriend, 24-year-old Crystal Jackson. Her father, James Larry Cosby, had been arrested in 1994 for sexual assault against a 22-year-old woman but was released in 2004. However, in 2011, he was sent back to jail for failing to register as a sex offender. When James was released in 2014, he was upset to find his daughter living with another woman. Regardless, he moved in with Brittany and Crystal, but had to sleep on the couch. Tensions in the home were escalating because they wouldn't let him use their car or share food with him. He also was allegedly a devout Muslim who hated the fact that his daughter was gay. Unfortunately, on March 6, James flipped out and began beating Brittany with a sharp-edged object before strangling her to death. After that, he choked Crystal before fatally shooting her. After they were dead, he loaded their bodies into the women's Kia Sorento and drove to Port Bolivar. Once there, he threw their bodies into a convenience store dumpster. He then drove back to Houston, abandoned the car at a strip club called The Ritz, and walked to a nearby Whataburger, where he called his girlfriend, Kimberly Pierce, to come pick him up. The next morning, a beer truck driver found Brittany and Crystal's bodies. When investigators arrived, they found a window shutter in the dumpster with a bloody fingerprint on it. Investigators later found that the shutter matched the ones on the home where the women lived. I'm not sure why there was a shutter from the house in the dumpster. It's possible he used it during the murders. There was also blood on the sidewalk outside. A forensic team came in and used luminol around the house, revealing Brittany's blood was everywhere, especially in the bedroom. On top of that, their Kia Sorento was missing. They discovered surveillance video of their SUV crossing on the Galveston Boulevard ferry the night before Brittany and Crystal were found. Two witnesses came forward and described the man they saw driving the SUV that night. Police then released a sketch of that suspect. The SUV was eventually found a month later when the owner of the strip club got tired of looking at it and had it towed. When the car was processed, forensics found both of the women's blood in the car, along with a single shell casing. When investigators questioned James, they found his lack of emotions odd and immediately added him to their suspect list. When investigators began putting two and two together, they realized that James was most likely the prime suspect, but they didn't have enough evidence yet to charge him with murder. So instead, they arrested him and charged him with evidence tampering. The FBI was then brought in to analyze James's cell phone data in order to determine his movements. What they found was that James had traveled from Houston to the Bolivar Peninsula and then back to the Ritz. He was then charged with capital murder. A motive has never been released, but according to community activist Quanell X, who was speaking on behalf of the family, they claim they found writings condemning homosexuality as a sin on Cosby's Koran. His own mother, LaRonda MacDonald, also believes his issues with his daughter's sexuality are what led him to murder her. However, another theory is that James felt disrespected having to sleep on the couch and was mad that Brittany and Crystal would order pizza and not share it with him. Over time, this caused tensions to build to the point where James completely lost it. Unfortunately, since James has never owned up to the crime, we may never know the true motive behind his horrific actions. In the end, the tampering charges were dropped, and he was convicted for both murders and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Maynard Fine was born on August 4, 1909, and married Helen Dickerson, who was born on April 1, 1923. In 1977, they were living in Maryville, Tennessee, and Maynard was retired from the Aluminum Company of America. On May 20, 1977, a telephone repairman came to their home after reports that calls to the couple weren't going through and stumbled upon a body in a car outside their home and called the police. Once there, investigators found the partially decomposed body of 54-year-old Helen resting limp on the steering wheel. She was trying to escape, but had unfortunately put the wrong car key in the ignition. When officers went inside the home, they found 67-year-old Maynard dead on the kitchen floor. They had both been dead for about 2 weeks and were killed by a .38-caliber gun. Robbery was ruled out as a motive because Maynard was found with a substantial amount of money in his wallet. It was determined that the couple was in the kitchen when Maynard was shot, and Helen had made it all the way out to her car before she was murdered. About a year later, they found the murder weapon in a local landfill, but due to lack of technology at the time, weren't able to link it to anyone. At that point, the case would go unsolved for the next 50 years. An early person of interest was the couple's son, Michael Fine. However, there was no evidence to tie him to the crime, but over the years, investigators kept tabs on him. In May of 2021, the case was reopened, and investigators had the forensic evidence from the case sent off for testing, including the murder weapon. Lo and behold, the DNA from the murder weapon and entry points on the home linked right back to Michael. On November 7, 2023, 80-year-old Michael was arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, and charged with first-degree murder. Police now have a motive in the case, but have not publicly released it. Interestingly, the couple had a 17 or 18-year-old living with them prior to the murder. I wasn't able to find out who this teenager was, but police are trying to track her down. She's not considered a suspect, so I assume they need her as a witness. Nohima Graber was born to Noe Castillo Aguilar and Maria Concepcion in Jalapa, Veracruz, Mexico on November 10, 1954. After graduating from school, she worked for 17 years as a flight attendant for the airline Mexicana. She also studied to become a commercial airline pilot and became one of the first women in Mexico trained to fly passenger jets. On October 4, 1986, Nohima married Paul Graber, and in 1992, they moved to Fairfield, Iowa, where she became an active member of the St. Mary Catholic Church. After her children were gone, Nohima, now in her 50s, enrolled at Iowa Wesleyan University, where she obtained her English degree and teaching certificate in 2006. Her first job out of college was teaching Spanish at Fairfield High School. Parents, students, and the other staff loved her, and she would even receive cards and letters from former students. She was also an avid walker and enjoyed reading in her spare time. One of her students, 16-year-old Willard Chaden Miller, really wanted to spend the summer in Spain to help build his college resume, but his only hurdle was his failing grade in Spanish. So on November 2, 2021, he met with Nohima, thinking she might help him in some way. The meeting apparently didn't go well, and instead of trying to bring his grade up by studying, he came up with a horrific plan to murder her instead. I'm not really sure why he thought that would fix his grade. Determined to put his plan into motion, he enlisted the help of 16-year-old Jeremy Everett Goodell. Later that same day, when Nohima went for her routine walk after school at Chautauqua Park, the teens followed her and ambushed her. They then beat her to death with a baseball bat. The following day, she was discovered under a tarp, wheelbarrow, and some railroad ties. A witness came forward and told investigators they saw Nohima's van being driven by two males, leaving the park approximately 42 minutes after she arrived. Within 2 days, investigators had already solved the crime, and Jeremy Goodell and Willard Miller were arrested. When they searched Miller's room, they quickly found the baseball bat that was used to murder Nohima. Miller initially denied his involvement, but once he knew they had enough evidence to prosecute him, he confessed to being a part of the crime. At that point, the two boys began blaming each other for the initial swing that hit Nohima. Goodell said that Miller hit her first, and he only struck her after noticing it didn't kill her, while Miller said Goodell struck first. However, prosecutors already knew that Miller was the only one with an actual motive to kill Nohima, and therefore didn't believe that Goodell was the one who struck her first. Both teenagers were tried as adults, but since they were 16 years old, the court was required to provide them with a chance of parole. Miller was a very arrogant person and was even caught saying that his IQ was higher than most of the staff at the jail, which upset the judge. As for Goodell, he had a horrible home life and had witnessed his mother and her boyfriend kick his sisters out of the home. A forensic psychologist testified in court that he was mentally immature for his age, and statistics showed that kids like him are more likely to engage in dangerous behavior. Goodell's mental state wasn't helped by his father, who was constantly on him about his schooling, and the administrators at the school. It was clear his defense team was trying to get the court's sympathy for him. However, Snapchat messages would reveal that Goodell openly discussed the plan with Miller on Snapchat. One caption read, "Time to hide a body," with a photo of a hand grabbing a bottle of Clorox bleach. Another read, "No, I'm actually ready. Here we go." He even sent a picture of someone holding a shovel because their original plan was to bury Nohima after murdering her. The only reason they didn't bury her is because the ground was too frozen to dig. Snapchat messages even showed how they were following Nohima. While the judge had more compassion for Goodell than Miller, they were both sentenced to life in prison. The only difference was that Miller would be eligible for parole after 35 years and Goodell after 25 years. Sierra Catherine Joggin was born in Sylvania, Ohio on February 11, 1996, and went by C. After high school, C enrolled at the University of Toledo, where she was majoring in human resource management. She was described as being full of life, with a great sense of humor, and loved to travel. In 2016, 20-year-old C was working an internship at her uncle's metal stamping company, Ice Industries, where she planned to work in human resource management once she graduated from college. She had also been in a 7-year relationship with her boyfriend, Josh Kolasinski. On July 19th, C was home from college for the summer and had gone to visit Josh. When she decided to leave, she got on her bicycle and Josh rode on his motorcycle along with her. This is a photo from that ride and the last photo ever taken of C. When they got close to County Road 6 near Metamora at around 6:45 p.m., they stopped. Josh then kissed her and told her he loved her and asked her to text him when she got home. He then turned around and went home while C continued. Sadly, she was never seen alive again. When she failed to arrive home, her mother, Sheila, was immediately concerned. She then received a call from Josh telling her he couldn't get in contact with her. At that point, the police were called and a massive search was underway. Later that evening, C's bicycle was discovered in a cornfield near where she had last been seen. They also noticed signs of a struggle due to the broken corn stalks and streaks of blood. There were also motorcycle tracks, along with a few items that didn't belong to C, including male sunglasses, a screwdriver, and a fuse box. A local farmer found a motorcycle helmet with blood on it and turned it into the police. Forensics determined the blood belonged to C, but there was also unknown male DNA on the helmet. Josh was quickly ruled out after investigators quickly found his motorcycle helmet. Investigators enlisted the help of the FBI, and they attempted to track her Fitbit and smartphone, but neither led to her whereabouts. Investigators began going door to door in the area, hoping to find a lead or possible witness. A sheriff with the Fulton County Sheriff's Office already had a person in mind that he wanted to speak with. That man was James Worley, who lived less than 2 miles away from the scene. When they arrived, they noticed that Worley was acting strange and then confessed that his motorcycle had broken down in the area and that he had lost a few items that matched the items found at the crime scene. He also claimed that he stumbled upon 2 bicycles and was originally going to ride one home but decided against it. He then strangely said to the investigators that he didn't steal anything or kill anyone. Eventually, a witness came forward and told investigators they saw a vehicle driving through the area at a high rate of speed. Thankfully, the witness was able to get the license number of the vehicle, and when police ran the plate, it was registered to Worley. Come to find out, Worley had been convicted in 1990 for assaulting and attempting to kidnap Robin Gardner after knocking her off her bicycle.
As soon as I was ready to turn around, I heard a car coming. That is the truck, and that's the one that hit me. So I flew into a ditch. So I got up from the ditch. He came up and I wasn't looking at what he was doing and he hit me over the head with a hammer on the left side of my head and I was terrified instantly. And the next thing I know, he opened the glove box and got handcuffs out. I just looked at them and I just instantly thought I was dead. And I just fought as hard as I could so he couldn't get both hands behind me.
She was then able to flag down a passing motorcycle.
When I got home, the police came, the ambulance came, and they said, "We found him. He's still at the scene of the crime." They found out his name is James Worley. I never knew him. No connection at all.
Worley was arrested and sentenced to 4 to 10 years in prison, but only served 3 before being released. Investigators then got a warrant to search his barn. Inside, they shockingly found a crate filled with women's lingerie and an empty, blood-stained freezer buried underground. They also found blood on his motorcycle, along with zip ties and a ski mask in his truck. The biggest piece of evidence was Cee's DNA on a piece of duct tape and on an inflatable mattress in the barn. At that point, they felt they had enough evidence, and on July 22nd, he was arrested and charged with her abduction. However, Cee was still nowhere to be found. Later that day, at 6 p.m., a person searching for Cee noticed a disturbed area in a cornfield. It also looked like something had been dragged for about 20 to 25 yards. When investigators arrived and searched the disturbed area, they found Cee's body in a shallow grave. She was gagged, her wrists were handcuffed behind her back, and she was wearing an adult diaper. A dog toy was used as a gag, and that's what ultimately suffocated her to death, most likely about 10 minutes after being placed in her mouth. There were no signs of a sexual assault. My only conclusion for that is he accidentally, or maybe purposely, murdered her before he got the chance. Worley's charges were then upgraded to 2 counts of aggravated murder and kidnapping, with the prosecution seeking the death penalty. Investigators believe that Worley passed Cee on his motorcycle and then hid in the cornfield further up the road. When she rode by, he attacked her by hitting her in the head with his helmet. They believe he waited until it was dark before returning home, where he got his vehicle and drove back to the spot. He then abducted her and took her back to his barn. After she suffocated, he took her body to another cornfield, dug a shallow grave, and put her body in it. On March 28, 2018, Worley was convicted and sentenced to death. His execution is set to take place on May 20, 2025. In 2018, Sierra's law was passed in Ohio, which created a violent offender database that law enforcement and residents can use to identify violent felons in their area. Sierra's family continues to campaign for the law to be passed in all 50 states. Tanya Nicole Cash was born in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, on October 15, 1981. Unfortunately, Tanya's parents had divorced when she was in middle school, forcing her to move from Monongahela, Pennsylvania, to McKeesport to live with her father, Jerry, and his fiancée. She also had to switch schools and was now a 14-year-old 8th grader at Cornell Middle School. Before moving in with her father, her mother had allegedly been violent and abusive toward her. Then, after the move, her mother rarely spoke with her. This caused quite a bit of stress in Tanya's life, and to make matters worse, she was being bullied at her new school. Unfortunately, in 1995, she had developed a crush on the security guard at her school, 38-year-old Thomas Hose. Hose had only worked at the school for about 6 months when he and Tanya began communicating. She confided in him about her parents' divorce and told him she felt unwanted and had considered running away. Hose then began grooming Tanya and using his position of authority to manipulate her. He began to frequently take her out of class to talk with her and would even buy her candy and cigarettes. Hose eventually convinced 15-year-old Tanya to move in with him, and on February 10, 1996, they put their plan into motion. He picked her up between the school and her house and took her to his house. However, this was not the start of a happy relationship. Unbeknownst to Tanya, she had actually been kidnapped and was about to live the 10 worst years of her life. When she failed to return home, her father reported her missing. At Hose's home, she was placed in a hidden room where she would endure sexual and psychological abuse. He even made her keep a journal of all their sexual encounters. She was also not allowed to take a shower more than once a week. Even more shocking was that he was hiding her there under the nose of his parents and 22-year-old son, who also resided in the home. To prevent them from discovering his secret, he made Tanya memorize the floorboards that creaked so she wouldn't make noise when she walked around. When Hose wasn't home, Tanya passed the time by reading magazines, listening to the radio, and watching TV with headphones on. In 2000, after being in captivity for 4 years, Hose came up with a plan to call her Nikki Allen, and then introduced her to his family as his girlfriend. She was then given a bit more freedom and could leave the house on occasion, but never told anyone because Hose had threatened to kill her and her family if she tried to run. Even with that, most days she spent locked in the second floor bedroom with only a bucket to use for the bathroom. As time went on, she began to accept her fate with this man she thought she loved. She accepted every order he gave her, even when he treated her like a dog. He even changed her hair color so that she wouldn't be recognized when she was allowed to venture outside. In 2006, Tanya got a lucky break when Hose was arrested on an unrelated charge and sentenced to prison. At that point, she got a part-time job at JJ's Deli Mart in McKeesport, owned by Joe and Janet Spirico. Over time, Tanya began building a relationship with the Spiricos, and about 8 months later, she finally told them the secret she had been keeping. She told them they could find a photo of her on the missing children's website. At first, Joe was skeptical of her story, but called his retired officer son, Sean, just to be sure. Sean was aware of Tanya's case and told his dad, "Don't tell me her last name is Cash." They couldn't believe it because for all these years, the police assumed she was dead. Hose was then charged with statutory sexual assault and involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. Judith Sokol, the hairdresser who colored Tanya's hair, was also charged with statutory sexual assault, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, indecent assault, and corruption of a minor. She was well aware of what Hose was doing and even allowed them to have sex in her home. She pleaded guilty to the charges. Sadly, after being reunited with her family, her father blamed her for the kidnapping. This forced her to make the tough decision to cut him out of her life. Tanya married in September 2018 and is now a mother to 2 stepchildren. She has since become an advocate for survivors of abuse and captivity. She uses her voice to shed light on the horrors of her own experience and to raise awareness about the importance of child safety. As for Hose, he eventually pleaded guilty to the charges and was sentenced to 5 to 15 years in prison. He served the entire sentence and was released in 2022. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time. Thank you.